Hi, and welcome to the third season of the Duck Industry Podcast, bringing you personal and truthful conversations. We acknowledge that the cultural establishment of which we are part still needs to undergo a fundamental transformation of true inclusivity. The Duck Industry Podcast is meant as a source of inspiration to envision a different way, a better way. We want to evolve together and dedicate ourselves to the work we have done so far and are committed to practicing further. We believe the future of this field lies in the power of the wide range of experiences, aesthetics, storytelling, and perspectives that you all have to offer. It's a great joy to welcome back our glorious partners and curators, the POC2 Programmers of Color Collective and the What's Up with Dogs podcast. We are also happy to introduce new collaborators, our colleagues from Kino Pravda Institute from Serbia, Belgrade. We look much forward to highlighting and celebrating the ideas, themes, and discussions our colleagues will bring to this. Duck Industry is funded by Creative Europe, the City of Leipzig, BKM, and MDM. We thank our partners and supporters for their contribution. Enjoy!
My name is Bedatri Chowdhury, and I use she, her pronouns. And today in this podcast, we have two fantastic guests who I'll be in conversation with. We'll be discussing documentaries, we'll be discussing the nonprofit model, and we'll be discussing how if we have better nonprofits, we'll have better documentaries. And in this conversation, we'll also be touching upon nonprofits and their missions and how they often mission wash, which is basically how they often hide behind their missions while doing, you know, unsavory stuff with labor and other stuff that we'll discuss more of. So today I have with me Hansen Bursek. Hi, Hansen.
Hello.
And what brings you here? Can you just give us a little introduction?
Hi, my name is Hansen Bursek. I use he, him pronouns. I'm coming to you from Pittsburgh, which is the occupied ancestral lands of the Haudenosaunee, Lenape, Osage, and Shawnee peoples. I'm a filmmaker, and I worked for film nonprofits pretty much my entire career. And currently I work at Outfest as their marketing manager. And it's just a little bit about me.
Yeah, Hansen, and what is your connection to documentary nonprofits that brings you here today?
Yeah, so I've worked at documentary nonprofits before. I notably worked at IDA before this. And while at IDA, the International Documentary Association, I was a part of the organizing efforts for the Documentary Workers United, DWU, which is a first of its kind union, which I was so fortunate to get up to work on with you, Bedatri, and it's been a really amazing journey to this moment, getting that first of its kind union and, you know, getting to have these conversations publicly for the first time that I think a lot of us are having in private. So that's really what brings me to this work and why I'm excited to be on this podcast.
Thank you. And as we demystify the history of the American nonprofit industrial complex mission statement, we'll also interrogate its role in maintaining a status quo of white supremacy at our institutions, which is something that's harming the labor relations, which is eventually harming the kind of documentary films we end up making. And to this and more, we'll speak Shakira Refos, our next guest. Shakira, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and what brings you to this conversation?
Yeah, sure. My name is Shakira Refos. I use she, her pronouns. What brings me to the conversation is, you know, professionally, I work full-time for the California Film Institute. We produce the Mill Valley Film Festival and Docklands Film Festival. We own a theater in San Rafael. And I also program documentaries for Tribeca. I'm an associate programmer there. What brings me to this conversation is, you know, I always tell people, I don't know anything about film. I know literally nothing. I didn't go to film school and came to this industry in kind of a unique way, which leads me to be sometimes a little bit more critical than I think others might have come into this space as being able to be, you know, power structures being the way that they mm-hmm. are. I question everything. I'm critical of a lot, especially just understanding as a Black woman, queer Black woman working in these PWIs, primarily white institutions, how things are ran the way they are. Why are things done the way that they're done? And why do we always kind of lean on the way things have always been done, when I always say, you know, we're in charge, we're in control, we're the administrators mm-hmm. here, we're the leadership.
Yeah.
So I think it's vitally important that we, you know, remain critical. I was born of two colonized atheists, so basically born to fight. And so I'm here to just like talk about how we can maybe think about things a little bit differently. And I love having those conversations. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and it's so exciting to hear that, because, and Hansen knows this, that my parents were union workers. So I, you know, I'll use that. I think I was born to fight and question these things too. So let's like, you know, jump into the conversation. As I said, it's about documentary nonprofits. It's about the nonprofit model in general, beyond documentaries even. And also trying to figure out who the documentary worker is, you know, someone who's not on set, someone who's not a quote unquote filmmaker, but their constant labor and efforts go into the making of a film that we put out in the world, that's like getting on the streamers, getting all these awards. And there has been somewhat of a movement within this space that, of course, we will talk about. Hansen spoke about a little bit already. So yeah, we'll basically talk about what are very toxic working situations and where do we place the documentary worker within them, and how can we imagine a better nonprofit model. But let's start from the beginning. Shakira, can you just tell us a little bit about, you know, the history of these mission statements?
Yeah, as I was doing research for the podcast, I kind of started to realize that the history of the mission statement isn't quite as relevant to this conversation, as opposed to how I kind of started interrogating our organization's mission statement mm-hmm. And the way that we do things. So I'm going to use California Film Institute as an example, because it's a place where I've had the opportunity to show immense growth and leadership and affect change in ways that are transformative to the Marin area, to the education community, the way that we engage folks in film and the conversations behind film. CFI has always been open to criticism, to critique, to being questioned, and the organization has really been super supportive in that way. But I first started to think about the role of an organization's mission statement as I witnessed film festivals and art houses, nonprofits, scramble to join what I can only describe as a trend of stating their land acknowledgments. What is a land acknowledgement? A land acknowledgement is a formal statement that recognizes and respects Indigenous peoples as traditional stewards of this land and the enduring relationship that exists between Indigenous peoples and their traditional territories. So that's kind of like an official understanding of what a land acknowledgement is. So it's symbolic, right? And as someone who grew up in the queer community, I see symbolism everywhere, and I don't always see like a lot of action. So I was kind of like drawn to the land acknowledgement as I was trying to understand what the acknowledgement is, what and what it means. And thinking about the importance of the land and its people, I was watching institutions rush to show us that they may understand the concept of a land acknowledgement without any real interrogation of the praxis. How have you historically contributed to the marginalization of Indigenous group and communities? So you're mm-hmm. doing the land acknowledgement, but you're not saying the thing. So taking CFI as an example, we here in Marin have leased in the past, have leased the theater that we own in San Rafael for $1. That land cost wow. us $1. And that happens traditionally along nonprofit institutions. It's yeah. a way for cities to keep arts and culture relevant, of course. But how are we going to state a land acknowledgement without saying that part about the land that we're on? In the words of cultural critic, educator, and community organizer TJ Galaxy, you're all theory without the practice, baby.
Yeah.
So I started to think, like, how can we be so wrong and so loud at the same time? Shouldn't one's mission statement prevent this kind of hypocrisy? Is a mission statement not the beacon of how to do things correctly, the guiding light of how to protect your communities? If not, what is actually the point of the mission statement? And what are we all really doing here? So in this research, I've really come to find the mission statement being the ultimate, long story short, the mission statement is the ultimate force for evil in the nonprofit industrial complex. It provides the organization with a symbolic crutch that prevents any policy or structural movement within it or programming from being questioned. So that's it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I know this is a podcast and you guys can't see our faces, but our heads will fall off from the nodding. Hansen, jump in.
Yeah, no, I mean, so much of what you said resonated so deeply. I think that, you know, we are at such an interesting time. And I'm seeing this a lot what you talked about with land acknowledgements, with accessibility right now. A lot of people want to talk the big talk about accessibility, and they want to get ahead of this, new wave of accountability that's happening. But in reality, they're still not doing the bare minimum of what accessibility best practices are. They want to say that they're a part of accessibility standards, but then they won't actually implement the accessibility within their own organization. I've been seeing it everywhere. So it's just, I completely agree with a lot of what you're saying. And as me and Padatri talked about a little bit in preparation for this, we see this a lot at organizations, this mission washing that kind of happens, this idea that, we sit in these rooms where we talk the big talk about doing this in the community, but in our own organizations or in practice, that doesn't ever happen. Sitting in an organization where we don't have a clear vision and we're just relying on a centuries old mission statement is really holding us back as a field, and has been I agree, a big threat to how we move forward in these organizations. Yeah,
and one thing, of course, what you're talking about, what you both just talked about, it reflects the larger nonprofit problem. But I also wanted to speak specifically about documentaries, because we are supposed to be changing the world, right? We are demanding all these accountable filmmaking practices, as we should. We are taking responsibility of people's lives and their life stories. And then we're making all these films where we are aiming towards a sense of responsibility, accountability, transparency, and what have you. What really amazes me is when documentary nonprofits do this. Like, I'm not saying it's okay for other nonprofits to do it, but this is what we are getting the money in for. And then just turning our backs and being very different people, not doing what we say we are doing. Shakira, did you want to add something?
Yeah, no, I think I want to do two things. So I want to say, for one, that we have this conversation a lot internally at CFI, where we realize that we're so busy putting together these events and doing the work that we're actually not really even talking about film. And maybe if we were talking about film more and about the awesome documentaries that give us these lessons about how to treat people, how to respect people, how to be more accessible. We're always showing documentaries about othered, marginalized, then how can we not know better, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's important. But just to state, we're all in the United States right now. DACA Leipzig is not. So let me just say, for everyone to understand specifically what a mission statement is, so that we're all coming all across the world. Hopefully everyone who's listening to this understands what we're talking about. So the American government, the IRS, Internal Revenue Service, and other government agencies rely on an organization's stated purpose, a mission statement, for evidence of its qualifications for sales, real estate tax, corporate exemptions at the state and federal level. An organization therefore must clearly communicate the justification for its federal tax exemptions as charitable, educational, and or religious. The purpose statement is also a key importance for directors and officers to fulfill the fiduciary duty of obedience. This legal duty requires each nonprofit leader to obey or adhere to this statement. But when's the last time you guys have sat in a room and like worked on a program and someone's been like, does this fit within our mission statement, even though that's how we are financially benefiting from these tax exemptions?
Yeah, no, I have always had problems with leadership in general, but board leadership, because at the end of the day, I just felt, and when I still work for a nonprofit, I'm a journalist now, I've moved away from the documentary field. It is a nonprofit newspaper that I work for with a for-profit section to it. I mean, that's very complicated and it's probably beyond the scope of this conversation. But one thing that has always struck me and amazes me is how a board of directors in a nonprofit who don't work there, who mostly are volunteering their time, I just don't understand the logic of them getting to decide our salaries, our hours, our policies. That is something I honestly think the nonprofit model needs to do better. And of course, like, you know, and as Hansen and I have, lived through ourselves, is like, of course, these are like field leaders, documentary filmmakers who are making these films, going out, very important members of the community. But how they can just turn up on the board and just let all that go, you know, like you said, Shakira, like when was the last time these people, like, you know, put forth a policy or a program which, forget the mission statement, lives up to even the stuff they you know, put out in their professional public lives. So yeah, and Hansen, I'd love to hear from you about this idea of leadership, and especially because you formed a union, which is not very common in nonprofits yet. Just, you know, a little bit about, if you can talk a little bit about nonprofits and the leadership model in general.
Yeah, I mean, and absolutely. I mean, I will certainly later in this conversation talk about exactly what happened with my particular situation. And unionizing in that space. But it was so interesting what we found out over the course of trying to, you know, talk about the issues that faced our union staff members. What essentially we found is like what I think most organizations would find if they had spaces to talk about this, that we didn't talk about this because we didn't have the spaces built in. Nonprofit workers are overworked almost all of the time.
Sorry, I'm underpaid.
And exploited. And the exploitation that happens with nonprofit workers is unique. When you work at a corporation, you absolutely get exploited. But you know, when you sign up to work at a corporation, there's a certain distance that you place, or many people place, between you and the place that you work, that you clock out at the end of the day. And, you know, any of the work that you do for your career is for money. And that is that. Whether it's, your passion or not, there's much more distance between you and your workplace in the corporate space for a lot of people. You're in the nonprofit space, and I come from advocacy nonprofits before I came to this space, and it's much worse there. But the idea that, you know, you care so deeply about the mission, about like why that organization exists, and that this organization is important, that you will accept less pay, that you will accept worse working conditions. You'll put this aside because you're told that you're doing this for the people, that it's altruism, it's charity, but it's not charity. It's your job, it's your workplace, and it's like what you do for a living to like—
It's also like my whole ass life. Like
exactly.
Yes, yes.
I'm a person.
And you know, the thing is that people don't talk about this, and it's what leads to burnout. It's what leads to good people leaving this work for corporate jobs because they have that distance. It leads to people like being so jaded and overwhelmed that they can't even interact with these spaces anymore that they care so deeply about. To speak to your point, Badatri, about leadership, is there's a distance that leadership has to this, where, you know, there the people in leadership, from my experience, so many of them have been through all of this that they just accept it as normal. They come from a generation where this is just normal. And it should never have been normal. And, you know, there's a certain amount of respect that I have for leadership, especially leadership who come from like marginalized communities, who've made their way to the top and work their way to get to where they are, to have that space and, you know, to be in that space. It's something in and of itself that is an accomplishment. But, you know, if we're not questioning, you know, why it takes so much work and time and it's so difficult for us to get to that space, for those people to get into those spaces, and for people in leadership to, you know, for somebody like me who works at nonprofits to find themselves in a leadership space, I don't think we're doing it right.
Yeah, and I also, and I'm sure Shakira will add to this, I also am very wary of the mission becoming the organization, becoming the person. Like, you know, it just becomes this conglomerate of, I don't know, trifecta of this godlike things that we can't question. And another, as someone who has left the documentary nonprofit space into and to go into a corporate workforce, I know at least there are systems in place for this. They might not work. It's more often than not a broken system, but at least there's a system in place, and I'm not just supposed to regard this individual because they have an Oscar, you know what I mean? Like, and this whole thing about the organization becoming the mission, becoming the person, is so problematic because we all know that's not the case. So, and that is another thing, and maybe our conversation can move to that, is sometimes people are just afraid of questioning these organizations because it becomes questioning the mission. And nobody's questioning the mission that you want to change the world and you want to bring in social change through effective storytelling. You'd have to be a monster to be against that mission. And I guess people just get shamed out of it.
So I think that like part of my reality check came from, you know, getting seasonal jobs at some of, you know, the one of the world's most renowned film festivals in the United States, and thinking this is going to be it. This is going to be everything. I'm working amongst the smartest and brightest in our industry. And then you get there and you want to have like a progressive conversations about, I come from the education space. I talk to kids about film for a living, you know? So I'm always leaning towards how can we really actually change minds here, and realizing that, oh, you guys don't know anything. Yeah. And actually even worse, just like how we said, oh, we have to like respect this person because they have an Oscar. Well, leadership, y'all let Harvey Weinstein rock for 25 years.
Ooh, Hansen will have something to say about this soon.
It's crazy how these organizations are still connected to like the old, terrible like systems of Hollywood and all this old stuff. And in a lot of ways, it's getting worse with the introduction of streamers. But that's a whole other conversation. I it's so funny to me. And, just playing off of what you said, it's to me, you know, it was when I moved across the country, you know, for a job in a nonprofit. And, you know, when I got there, it was a lot of talk about like big, exciting, progressive things. And I was reading things about, you know, organization and the organization I was working for becoming more progressive and the leadership changed. Everything was exciting. And then, you know, with like that, we had a shift in leadership and things changed. And it reminds me that these nonprofits aren't built in a way that many of these nonprofits aren't built in a way that's sustainable, that leadership can change so rapidly over such a short period of time. I've watched it happen over literally months, such a short period of time where leadership changed that it could become a completely different culture in 2, 3, 4 months. a year. I mean, and then you're working, you sit there and you wake up one day and you're like, what? This is not the organization I'm even working. What organization am I working for anymore? You have to, you know, and that's the thing about these nonprofits, because there's a lot of volunteerism and board volunteerism and, you know, leadership volunteerism, that there's a lot of people who go from place to place to place to place. It really can shift just like that, going from a place mm-hmm. where, you know, you have momentum and things are building, and then just like that, it's all gone. Part of it's, of course, burnout. You know, it's part of it, because a lot of these people donate, they give a lot of their time, and they can't, it's not sustainable in that way. But also part of it is leadership, you know, and, you know, who's in charge and who makes the decisions, and tracking that, you know, how that moves over the course of a period of time.
Yeah. And also, like, you know, I'm hearing this and I'm thinking, and just occurred to me the amount of ego in this. Like, you know, with each leadership change, everything becomes a hobby project. Everything becomes your property. I mean, it's not, though. Like, why should change in leadership, why should organizational change become a community issue every time? And we've seen this in most nonprofits. Like, every time there's a new leader, there's something happening which involves the whole community. But, like, no one has the time, yo. Like, you know, it's like, there is, like you said, there is often no succession plan. There is often there's no blueprint. But everyone coming in and changing things the way they want to do it is so much, like, it just, like, screams ego at me. And I could be wrong. What do you guys think?
Well, I mean, if we're given the power to say, like, what you're doing is going to change the world, at a certain point you might start to believe that, actually, when really what we're doing is watching movie, like, on, you know, I mean, films do have the power to change the world, but that just doesn't happen just by screening them.
I was just, like, saying, it's so funny that you said that, because I have this working theory that this is especially bad for filmmakers who become these leaders of organizations and work in these institutions, because, you know, I went to film school. You know, it is a lot of problems. You know, filmmakers are told all the time that they need to constantly be talking about themselves, constantly self-promoting, constantly saying that that their film is the next best thing, the next best thing, the next best thing. And I think that, mixed with, you know, being in the documentary field, where you're told that the work that you're doing is making a difference, and that, you know, you are working on these big projects that oftentimes do make a difference in some level, you know, that you have this combination where you're, like, looking at yourself in the mirror and you're saying, I'm the best thing since sliced bread, mixed with the fact that you think you're changing the world. It's a recipe for ego
death. And you're doing it, quote unquote, voluntarily. Of course that comes with privilege. And again, like, you know, just to reiterate something that might be very obvious, is it's not just grant making nonprofits, it's not just educational nonprofits here, but, you know, across the board, we've had film festival workers pushing for accountability, and, like, in huge places, like, I know Film at Lincoln Center, which organizes the New York Film Festival, was bargaining for a contract last year. They were picketing outside the film festival last year. So it's across the board. And we've heard about Ambulante in Mexico, which, you know, just lost pretty much all of its, I mean, when I say lost, they were let go, pretty much all of its workforce through the pandemic. And then the coming back to work was very random. And, like, sloppy, and some people got their jobs back, some didn't. So it's across the board, like, you know, I know it can get very insular to think about the situations we've been in, but this is happening everywhere. And of course, there is sometimes, like both of you have touched upon, it becomes a moral thing, because there is apparently something cool about, like, showing that you're averse to money, when the reality is very different. Like, you know, we've all read this recent Hollywood Reporter article about just the massive amount of cash grab that's happening within the nonprofit ecosystem, and how nonprofits just maybe more often than not play a role in either getting that money granted to them, but they also hold this moralistic position of being a nonprofit, and you don't want to touch that because then you're with the bad guys. But the truth is, as the article tells us, and as we all know through our experiences, that we are already shaking hands with these quote-unquote bad guys, right?
I just want to tell a quick story and then hand it over to Hampton, who is probably going to, you know, be able to talk about this way more eloquently than I am. But the story here is there's a LGBTQ plus forward a film festival in the Bay Area where I live. I'm not going to, you know, name any names, but what it must feel like to sit in the Castro Theater, like one of the most historic and important places in American queer history. It's opening night. You have all the gays from everywhere just here to celebrate this film festival. You raise the curtain after the organ plays, of course, because that's what we have here at the Castro, the organ player. And a Wells Fargo commercial starts playing and the entire audience starts to boo. Like, that can't feel good. But that's also the type of thing is like, is this really what our audience wants? Like, what experience are we wanting to give our audience as opposed to what do we think we're supposed to do? Because if you ask the audience, like, do you want this festival to be sponsored by Wells Fargo? They would probably say, fuck no, especially that specific audience.
Yeah, and I remember being at Hot Docs earlier this year, and Canada is, like Toronto at least, is famous for having big bank sponsors for its film festivals. And someone in the audience said that in Toronto, the festivals are for the banks. Like, you know, be it Scotia Bank, be it TD Bank, they're like big sponsors of film festivals. And also within that, what does it mean to show a film executive produced by Hillary Clinton? What does it mean to also have a film about Laura Poitras, who cares so much for surveillance? What does it mean for both of these people to have their films play at the same festival? It's like, it's important to note here that TIFF is a nonprofit. What does it mean? Like, where are we standing? Hansen, I see you nodding your head.
Yeah, and first of all, before I even go into it, the Castro Theater crowd is my saving grace. I'm so happy every time they are audible. I love it. It's the energy we need. But yeah, I mean, it's huge. And, you know, obviously I work for a film festival now. I work for Outfest in Los Angeles. And, you know, I don't think I've worked there long enough to make any like hot takes about like what's going on. And so I won't. And I genuinely like the job. So I'm gonna keep my mouth shut. you know, it's crazy. I mean, like the thing is that we live in this space where the COVID just decimated the nonprofit ecosystem for most nonprofits, especially arts nonprofits, because they were always the first on the chopping block. So, you know, we had to turn to, you know, to something. And so a lot of organizations turned to corporate sponsorship. And inherently, corporate sponsorship isn't bad, but you have to think about your audience and what you represent and what you're working on and how you're, you know, you're using that money and how much impact that money has, where that money is coming from on your everyday. If you have a grant or a sponsorship or a program or a festival or a screening about something, whatever that may be, you know, and you're screening a documentary about about a social justice topic or about, you know, a marginalized community, and the sponsor is an organization that actively works against that community, you have a problem. And it gets worse, you know, the more money you take and how much stipulation is on that money. So it's a slippery slope. And I think, you know, it's something to keep an eye on coming up in the future.
Yeah. And, you know, neither of us here think we should do the emotional labor of fixing this. Neither do we get paid enough to fix this. But Hansen, I would love for you to talk about unionizing in general within the documentary nonprofit space here, but also Shakira. What, you know, where do you see hope in this? Where do you see things changing, which you think we should highlight and spotlight in this conversation?
Yeah. First of all, before I even go into this, you know, me unionizing IDA, I mean, that was like a group effort. And I think Badatri's sort of underplaying her role in that. She was a major part. We organized it together. It was me, her, our amazing coworker, Eddie Hasabi, and then Crystal Sotomayor, who are they're running it now. And it was, I mean, it's a great group. And, you know, this really was a staff-led effort. But, you know, just to talk about it, I mean, I think the unions, you know, I don't think that unions are like the sole solution to fixing the nonprofit ecosystem. I just don't think there is a sole solution to fixing a nonprofit ecosystem. When we unionized, people had a ton of, and still do have a ton of problems with IDA and how it's run and blah, 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 blah. You can read about it. It's everywhere. You can Google it. But, you know, when we were unionizing, I think a lot of people thought that that was the solution to the problem. Oh, the union will fix the problem. And it again comes down to the staff. I mean, like, people think that working people, you know, who have 9-to-5 jobs where we were getting paid, I was getting paid entry-level salary, organizing a union on the side, I was going to solve the problems at IDA. And I don't think that that is very fair. But on top of that, I mean, who has the time? You know, what we organized and we unionized out of necessity. You know, it was a necessity. We wanted a voice at our organization. We needed better pay. We needed better treatment. You know, there was no alternative to unionizing. It was, we either leave the organization, which many people did, or we unionized. And that's the solution that we came up with for our own survival and for our own care. But beyond that, you know, we're also people who work in the community and do genuinely care about our organization, and thought that having a bigger voice and having staff have a bigger voice would change our organization for the better. And I think it has. But I think that it's a part of the solution. And and I think that, honestly, I think that every nonprofit should be unionized. I think that there are special things that nonprofit workers deal with that other workers don't, that takes a bigger toll on you. And I think this is across the board, and especially for advocacy organizations, as somebody who has to deal with trauma on a day-to-day basis. And again, I'm sure that again, Google it. I'm sure you can understand how much trauma goes through with nonprofit workers who work at more advocacy-based or healthcare-based organizations. But but even for us at an arts organization, you know, there is just so much labor that we are asked to do for free, for nothing, for pennies. And then we're expected to, you know, be a solution? I don't think so. But I will say, you know, supporting unions and having unionized workplace is a part of the step forward with holding organization leadership accountable. And I think that that's what people want the most, is an organization being accountable to the people. And the staff, in many ways, and it was the same at IDA, are the people it represented. We were filmmakers, we were programmers, you know, we were people, we were journalists, and therefore we were the community in a lot of ways. Yeah, I mean, I think unionizing is really key, a key part of this conversation.
Yeah, and then, you know, I remember when we unionized, when our union got recognized, there were our colleagues in other documentary nonprofits, other guilds, other collectives, who literally said, wow, we didn't know that could happen. So, you know, just I think just that bit of knowing this can happen, knowing this is an option, and which I know, Shakira, you wanted to speak about this and you feel very passionately for this, as do all of us, is this idea of information sharing, this idea of letting people know that you're not alone in this, and this is what happened to me, so keep an eye out, it might happen to you. So what has been your experience with that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think I spoke a little bit earlier about like how in the past I've kind of idealized, or, you know, organizations or pedestalized specific programmers, thinking that that was going to be like the way to a better world, which is like something I'm constantly trying to figure out how to do in my personal life and with the power I have in my professional life. How can we change the world that, how can I live in the world I really like want to see? How can I contribute to that? It's definitely not through idolatry. That's not how that's going to work. So nope. I think that part of it is where I find hope in watching people kind of kill their idols, kill what the institute means in their heads and why. Thinking specifically, like, we work in the space where idolatry is kind of part of where the money is. We, more than like needing to share more information, we didn't really think we were being abused for a long time.
Yes, that feeling of being gaslit, yes.
So I think what's really important here is the people I idolize most, which is I still idolize people, but they're actually people who don't want to be idolized at all. And I'm talking about like Sonia Childress, for Color Congress, Gemma Desai, who was just like never ending brilliance, mm-hmm. Sarah Ty Black. I had the privilege of being in a conversation with the two of them earlier this week. Gemma Desai, "This Work Isn't For Us." We'll constantly talk about that document. Please read it. It's open source. And then also Lucy Paul, Themba and Hussein at the Programmers of Color Collective, who are really helping us push towards having tough conversations, but also getting together and having like finding the hope in where a lot of what we love about this work originates is a sense of community. We will be able to do better together, but we have to really trust each other. For us to be able to trust each other, we have to break down some of the harm we've done, be really honest and transparent about that, apologize, and just work towards moving better as a group.
Yeah, and then to that amazing list of superstars and badasses, I want to add the work of the Documentary Accountability Working Group, which Sonia Childress is, of course, a member of. And I have just sat in amazement and in awe of the work they've been doing in their demands for accountability and transparency, especially when it comes to documentary filmmaking. And my hope really is that somebody, or maybe we, through conversation, through community, extend that work to ask for accountability in all the other sectors of the documentary ecosystem that fall beyond the direct filmmaking aspect of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a big advocate for community and talk with your coworkers. I mean, like, have these hard conversations. And, you know, I think that a good apology is such an important thing. I wish people were better at apologizing. I think that it's completely normal, and I don't think it should be something that is shameful. And I really truly think it should be something that's regular. You know, I mean, we're humans, we all make mistakes,
And perfection, I think perfection, and this is something we've learned from our colleagues at Working Films, and please read up about it. It's online. They have a fantastic power sharing model. They talk about how perfection is a white supremacist thing. Like, you can't have perfection. Let's just start from there, that we'll screw up. And when we screw up, you tell me I'm screwing up. And when you screw up, I tell you when you're screwing up. And you don't lose your job for this.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned Working Films, because if we're talking about nonprofit models and how we can shake them up and make them better, I think that you can look no further than Working Films. I'm still keeping an eye on how they're doing things and seeing how successful they are. It seems like they've been so successful so far. But, you know, talk about an organization that has really looked inward and like made, you know, had some really hard conversations and made choices that I think are to the betterment of everyone that they serve. I think we need to really be looking at organizations like Working Films and trying to think, you know, what leadership models work for us, not what leadership models are standard or not what leadership models are like a best practice according to some like 50, 60, 70 year old white guy who has, you know, studied nonprofits, but from a very particular perspective, but what models work for the communities that you serve in that organization and all documentary community organizations that serve, you know, the nonfiction space need to be having this conversation and need to be having like these kind of like heart to hearts about like, how can we make our model better?
Yeah, absolutely. And also like what leadership model works for you, and you not necessarily looks good on a grant application, right? Like, you know, we place too much power on these foundations, which is a whole different conversation. So what I'm hearing is, and I'll take your last thoughts on this, that accountability and transparency, which is something we already have a model of when it comes to documentary filmmaking, because we are trying to put those practices in place. So what I'm hearing is expanding those ideas to accommodate the documentary worker, as we spoke of earlier. Your last thoughts, Shakira.
Yeah, I want to give a shout out to two Instagram pages I think have been really helpful in exposing some like real harmful practices at organizations around the country and at times around the world, sharing articles, getting people together, which is at Fest Staffer Stories, one word, and Off the Fest Circuit. So at Fest Staffer Stories and off the Fest Circuit, both Instagram pages that popped up, I would say during the pandemic, and just started talking about what we haven't been talking about. Everybody knows about whisper culture, but again, you have to really understand that you are being abused in order for whisper culture to even come off the ground. So yes. I want to give a shout out to those two pages for helping us understand what's happening around the country. And just to anybody listening here, like if you feel something is weird or something is kind of off, like it probably is, you know, don't be afraid to investigate and interrogate the organization you work for. Check out the mission statement if you're in the United States and ask some questions about like, how am I contributing to this by maybe not, you know, being critical enough and talking enough with my colleagues. It is your duty. It is our duty to all to continue to share information.
Yeah, and another Instagram account on the same vein is at Nonfiction Unite, which also does you know, something similar where nonfiction producers and production workers share their stories. Yeah, and then, you know, echoing what Shakira said, like Hansen and I, we had the idea of a union literally on a phone call saying, what on earth can we do to fix things, or like to at least not have things be this bad? So, you know, seek people out, and like Shakira said, if you think something's amiss, it probably is. So just trust your gut with that and speak to your coworkers. Hansen.
Yeah, I mean, huge plus ones to what both of you said. Unionize your coworkers. Like, I know that's like a scary thought, but like it's such an important step forward. And you'll find more likely than not there are more people that you work with who think like you if you start talking to your coworkers. You know, these systems aren't perfect, and you know, it's definitely a hard leap to make, but I'm a huge advocate for it. It changed our lives. It really did. And, you know, I'm hoping that the Documentary Workers United is like the start of something. And on top of that, you know, me and Badatri have both talked about this. You know, if you want to unionize, or unionizing is part of something that you think would be better in your workplace, the best first step is to, of course, talk to your coworkers, get a group of people together, a good group of folks who are all interested in exploring this. It doesn't have to be all your coworkers, but a good group of your coworkers together, and contact a local, find a local that works for you. And essentially how unions work is that, you know, you are a part of a local and part of a bigger organization. We unionized with CWA. There's also, I'm trying to think off the top of my head, which union the Academy Museum workers unionized with. I know that, and I think that with a lot of the theater workers in New York, it's been actually United Steelworkers, I think, which is actually really
UAW.
Funny. UAW.
Yes.
United Auto Workers. That's right.
Auto
that's
workers.
Right,
that's right. Yeah.
You just need to find the local that is right for you. You just contact them, reach out, cold call. They get these all the time. Set up a meeting, have them come in, talk to your coworkers, answer your questions, go over the risks and see if it's right for you. Sometimes it's not, sometimes it is, oftentimes it is. You know, if you won't know unless you take that first step, and it really does make the difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that all of us have rent to make, insurance to pay for, but you know, and all of us are scared of losing our jobs, but please know that each one of us, unionized or not, are safeguarded by a lot of rights. So maybe just talk to your local and just know about those rights. And but most of all, seek out coworkers, speak to them, knowledge sharing, transparency, that's where it's at. Thank you so much, Shakira and Hansen. I could not have thought of two better people to have this conversation with.
Yay, this was fun.
Yeah, and thank you to our friends at Doc Leipzig for letting us, you know, just chat and make a great day out of this. And thank you for giving us this platform.
Appreciate it. You all have a great day. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, you so much. Care.